first given this fork, I was like, great, what a great coffee. And then I was like, oh my God, what a huge topic. We're literally talking about in dozen countries with kind of revolutionary mass uprising, with no revolutionary processes that last over years. Not been explaining all of that in a kind of talk. Just the narrative would take me a couple of days. I'm not going to do that. The other thing I thought is all these debates about the Arab Spring, like how much were they revolutions, like what went wrong, should they have ever happened before? There's all of these debates from both the left and the right about the Arab Spring. Again, that's a massive talk. And then I thought to myself, actually, let's take a step back. What is the most important thing for people who want to see a better world, for people who are kind of angry at the system, for revolutionaries to understand about the Arab Spring? And that's the talk I'm going to give you today. The first thing, sorry for the awkward setup. The first thing to understand is the world before the Arab Spring. I was an activist, and the kind of pre-2011 world is a world where people didn't think mass trouble was possible anymore. Since the kind of 80s, there hadn't been mass uprisings really around the world. This idea that the working class doesn't exist anymore, that kind of change is impossible, kind of really dominated politics. For example, ignore the awkwardness. I used to campaign for Palestine, and we would argue that the road to liberation of Palestine went through the Egyptian masses, went through the working class of Egypt. And people would say, that's ridiculous. There is no way the Egyptian masses will rise. The security state's too strong. It's just not going to happen. And in that world, it's the same in this world, isn't it? That the millionaires keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. This is, of course, the era of the war on terror and America's occupations of the Middle East, where we watched these kind of invasions that killed a million people and counting. It's the time of the GFC, where the billionaires around the world got all of this kind of government money to bail them out, and the working class of the world lost their jobs. I Googled the figure. Let me find it. Oh, I should have highlighted it. Tens of thousands of people lost their jobs in the GFC. Like, literally tens of thousands of people on the scracker. Oh, here we go. This is why I Googled it, because I knew I was going to underestimate it. In 2009, 205 million people globally lost their jobs. All of this money went to the banks and the richest, and all of these people were thrown on the scrap heap. Homelessness became a mass phenomenon. Tent cities sprung up across the US, the richest country in the world, the richest country in human history. People were living in tents. People were dying of exposure. The rich, now that their stock market was crashing, took all of their money and put it in things that were secure. Things like food and futures on food, which meant the price of food around the world skyrocketed. Which meant, of course, people in places like Haiti started feeding their children dirt because they couldn't afford to feed them food. That's the world we lived in before 2011, and everybody thought nothing would ever change again, that this was what we were getting used to. The ruling class ruled, and the rest of us got pummeled. Then things changed. And it's one of the things that I really want to get across, that, like, mass change is unexpected. You don't think it's going to happen. No one can predict it. One day you just wake up and all of a sudden the masses are on the street. The spark is, of course, Tunisia. I've got a typo. On the 17th of December, Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire to protest government policies. He was not the first person in the world to have set himself on fire as a protest, but for some reason, this time, this provoked mass protest. And these protests were then violently repressed by the Tunisian government, and they created a pattern where there would be funerals for the people who'd been killed in the protests, and those funerals would turn into protests, which would then be cracked down on, and then there'd be more funerals and protests, and a wave of kind of mass protests across Tunisia broke out. It lasted just under a month until the dictator, Ben Ali, who had ruled Tunisia for 25 years, resigned. 25 years. Took them less than a month to get rid of him with mass protests. The Tunisian revolution had won. But it still wasn't clear what was going to happen. In fact, most people had never heard of Tunisia. This was not a mass phenomenon. But the people who had heard about Tunisia, the people who were inspired dramatically by Tunisia, the people that would change the world were Egypt. Egypt is an important country economically in the Middle East. It is a large country, a centre of production, politically important, and big. When Egypt rose, the world noticed. Okay, so 25th of January is Egypt's first protest. I'm going to take a bit of time to talk about the Egyptian revolution because some of the lessons that come out of Egypt, I think, are the really important ones for us to learn and hold on to and remember in those dark days when nothing's changing, what happens when people rise up. So let's start with them. 25th of January, there are big demonstrations in Egypt, mass demonstrations. They are repressed. They attempt to occupy Tahrir Square and they are smashed out of it. The police repress them. In the next couple of days, there is all sorts of organising that happened. There's all sorts of really interesting solidarity that happens. Like, for example, a bunch of activists in Palestine write a pamphlet that is like, this is how you deal with tear gas when you get tear gas. This is what you do in response to this kind of oppression of the police force. It was then widely shared in Egypt because that's what they were facing. The ruling class, of course, attempted to stop this. One of the key things that the Egyptian government did that everybody that they thought was really going to stop it is about the 27th of Jan, they turned off the internet because they were like, if people can't talk to each other, they definitely can't organise. How wrong they were. I'm going to show you this in a minute. So there's no communication. So instead what people do, because they want to go back and occupy Tahrir Square, this is the heart of what they're going to do. They're going to have an occupation that'll like get rid of the dictator. And they kind of can't talk to each other on the internet or whatever. So instead they start demonstrations in each of their neighbourhoods. People kind of start in small numbers. They call out their neighbours, their friends, their whatever. And these small demonstrations move suburb to suburb and get big and big and big and big. And by the time they start reaching the heart of Cairo, you have hundreds of thousands of people marching to reoccupy. And one of the really important things about a revolutionary process is that people will no longer be ruled in the way they used to be. That is one of the key things that happens in a revolution. This is called the Battle of the Bridge, and I really hope it works. The sound is not going to work, but that's okay. You don't need to hear this guy chatting. This is the 28th of January. This is protesters attempting to get to Tahrir Square to reoccupy. What you're going to see is a bunch of water cannons and other such thing. Steve, there's the cops come in. This is the day the protesters lost their fear. Those protesters are about to stand up against the most advanced anti-protest weaponry, and they're going to win. They actually push back all of those cops. They push back the water pen, and they break through, and they reoccupy Tahrir Square. In revolutions, people will no longer be ruled the way they used to, and this is a great example of it. Tahrir Square. The Festival of the Oppressed. Marxists call the revolution the Festival of the Oppressed because it shows what is possible when ordinary people start to run the world. Harvey Square was a like example of the miraculousness of what ordinary people can do. Tahrir Square had a hospital that volunteer doctors and nurses kind of treated people's injuries. They had a volunteer lawyers. They had a kitchen. They had all of these things. They had police checkpoints. I want to take a moment to talk about the checkpoints. So there's all of these thugs that are attacking the protesters, yeah? The government is trying to kind of smash them on the streets. And so the protesters set up like perimeters around it where kind of people have to go in and get checked. People who visited say it's the most polite checkpoint you've ever been to, where people are like, we're so glad you're here. Come on in. I just got to check before weaponry. Thank you for being here. Come on, just let me check you. I'm going to let you in. People are organising themselves to defend themselves, to look after each other, to do all sorts of things. People are cleaning the streets. This is literally the first day of the revolution. And when asked what they're doing, people are like, we're making a new Egypt. So, of course, we have to make sure we sweep up all of the dust because this is going to be our new world. Actually, a world organised by ordinary people looks beautiful. In that struggle, oppression is challenged. Marxists talk about the need for a revolution to get rid of the muck of ages, to get rid of all the things that have held people down and held people back. Here's just two examples. The first, they're both really important. Muslims and Christians protect each other. Sectarian divisions is one of the key ways of the ruling classes of Middle East wars. It's the way they divide people, it's the way they oppress people. It's like religious divisions. And those had a big impact on ordinary people in the Middle East. In the Arab Springs, they were overcome, they were challenged. This is people protecting each other. And actually, since the Arab Spring, those sectarian divisions were not there to come. The kind of projects and all of that. So it's like, it watched, they changed themselves and they kind of changed mass consciousness as part of it. The other thing is women. The like kind of repressive, kind of backwards ideas that kind of hold women down are just overthrown. Reports from within the square, one of our comrades who visited Tahrir Square said she could not describe what it was like because she had never in her life existed in a place where she wasn't objectified as a woman. And she was just like, it's so hard to explain and it's so hard to even imagine that a place could exist where you are your political ideas, you are the action you're taking, you are the kind of solidarity with others rather than all of these categories of oppression. The other thing that often gets ignored in and after the Arab Spring is the role of workers. Let me make sure I read my notes so I get all the things right. So the occupation of Tahrir Square operates for a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, before the working class starts an indefinite strike. So workers from electricity workers, farmers, museum staffers, government tax collectors, Mahalla textile, factory workers, the people who repair ships on the Suez Canal dock workers, walk off these Suez Canal workers, walk off and say, we are not going back to work until Mubarak falls. And then all of a sudden, the situation is changed. The ruling class of Egypt may have weathered an occupation. They may have said, it's all right, we'll put up with it. People will go home eventually. What they could not weather was the kind of loss of production and profits and kind of economic damage that the working class did, but also the potential that those workers could then start to reorganise society and start to learn that they had the power in society to fundamentally change the law. They could not weather that. 2 days after this indefinite general strike, they announced the fall of Mubarak. I got another video for you. Oh, but you can't hear the sound. This is the announcement of Mubarak falling. Again, Mubarak had been a dictator for decades. For some people, had lived their entire life under the kind of iron fist of Mubarak. There are 24 million people in Tahrir Square when it is announced that Mubarak resigns. and the sound of their joy is something I will never, ever forget. You may or may not hear it now.
They be waiting. Stinnerberg has gone.
Look at him, what did it actually sound like? And one of the things to note is this was broadcast around the world. I watched this live. It was fantastic. So did millions of other people. This was what kind of joy of victory millions of us are inspired. I encourage you to look up later. give yourself a 10 seconds.
Yep. Listen to
That victory in Egypt spreads the revolution across the Middle East. Egypt is an important country politically, economically, and that inspiration, the idea that you can overthrow your dictator, just reverberates. By March, the next month, there are mass movements from Morocco to Oman, Syria, Jordan, even Iraq, all kind of fighting for democracy and decent living standards. The regime started offering reforms and kind of saying that increased wages, all of this kind of stuff. It did not work. Country after country rose up to try and fight. This is a usual bit of a sense about the kind of mass nature of this third. Revolutions of the Black Nuns, civil war, protest and government changes. Like, there is just kind of mass movements across the Middle East fighting for similar things and in similar ways to the Egyptian revolution. And a lot of the times the analysis of the Arab Spring focuses on the nature of class rule in the Middle East as the reason for the Arab Spring. And that is actually really important. Like, we recognise that the Middle East is susceptible to kind of revolutionary ways because of its position in the world and the kind of nature of class rule there. It is the kind of centre of the world and a battleground for imperialism, which means there is the kind of horrific examples of what capitalism and kind of class, how it looks like. For example, Palestine. The class. There is the kind of class rule that in the Middle East is like stark and brutal. You have kings and dictators who live in palaces, and you have the majority of people who like suffer immiseration in a land of plenty. So kind of revolution is kind of happens in waves. It happens kind of semi-regularly. But the thing that people often miss is that it didn't stop there. The revolutionary wave caused by the Arab Spring reverberates around the world. I don't have time to tell you all of the countries. I don't have time to show you the pictures of all of the countries. But firstly, we have the movement of the squares. Then we have Occupy Wall Street. Here's some protesters fighting through cops so that they can march on the streets and occupy Wall Street. And then that moves on to occupy everywhere. Most major cities in America have an occupation. You literally cannot count the amount of cities and countries in the world that have an Occupy movement. All of them, over and over again. This is just a sample of pictures that I decided to give you. I couldn't count all the Wikipedia listings of all of the kind of protests that happened as part of the Occupy movement. And there's one thing I want to say really, well, there's two things I want to say. The first one is that example of what ordinary people could kind of create when they kind of involved in the struggle. This is London, but this is a bit of a model of what Occupy was. It was in its strength and its weaknesses, people attempting to reconfigure the world in a better way, which meant organising themselves. It meant like having jobs that people could do, and they're Occupy now, but like literally every day I went there, something new had been kind of built and created. There was a garden, there was a kitchen, there was all of these kind of things, there was a library, there was people were attempting to create a better world.
That's one important thing.
The second important thing is it changed the political narrative. All of a sudden, the like dominant slogan, you hear it now, the 99% against the 1%. The problem in the world is the parasites, the 1%. Before that, the problem in the world was the global south versus the global north. The like Occupy changed the world and made it about the billionaires and the way they run the world. And the mass of us have an interest together wherever we are in the world against them. Let's hold on to that because that's amazing. The other really important thing to understand is that the Occupy movement wasn't a solidarity movement, although there was lots of solidarity. Someone wants to give the example of the pizza stores that are like buying pizzas for Tahrir Square and the occupation in Madison and the like protests in Haiti and there's all this stuff going on. But actually, the Occupy movement was mass protests in each country about issues in a class kind of divisions and exploitation, could call it, in those countries. I only have time to give you two examples. The first is Occupy Seoul. This is Occupy Seoul. Occupy Seoul protest was about one of the key demands was a trade deal that President Park had just signed with the US that was going to be massively unequal. This is the 2016 protest that both had her deposed and put into jail or corruption. The Occupy movement was part of this kind of mass protest, and there's a series of mass protests in Seoul that lead to this. There's also some far-right protests, and there's some very interesting things that happen. This is a very little-known one, Occupy Hong Kong. Occupy Hong Kong is super cool. So the occupation in Hong Kong, it's the kind of 25th of October, the same day as the rest of the world. They first occupy Central, which is the kind of financial district, and then they're like, huzzah, look what we did. Let's go occupy some more places. And they go and set up three other camps, including in Hong Kong, which is a her central working class district. And if Hong Kong, they didn't just be like, oh, we're going to go to a park. They're like, this key road, this the intersection, this is where we're going to occupy. And the way they achieved it is the bus drivers in Hong Kong used their buses to block the roads so that people could occupy them and set up their camps. They lasted for a week or so, not that long. I eventually got smashed them off the street. But then in 2014, when there was a move by the Chinese Communist Party to take back some of the democratic rights of Hong Kong, they were like, well, you know what we're doing? They set up another occupation in both of the locations with the lessons they had learned, including don't trust the cops, that were then also eventually smashed off the streets. But then flow into the 2019 rebellion, the Umbrella Movement, which was an incredibly significant kind of uprisings of masses in Hong Kong that was brought to a abrupt end by the pandemic. We'll see what happens next. I'm about to go into the fall of the Arab Spring because I'm running out of time. But before I do, I really want to throw this in a little bit more. The Arab Spring and uprisings, they weren't just about kind of people's, but they're about democracy, they're about people's kind of economic conditions. But when people get some confidence, when they stand up for themselves, when they start to win, when they start to kind of see that they've got allies and this kind of stuff, they get confidence and they start to look broader. 2011 saw the biggest protests for Palestine ever. The Great March of Return on Nakba Day in 2011 literally saw hundreds of thousands of people attempt to march back Palestine. And it was the biggest kind of collection of Palestinians in the world since Nakba, since they'd been displaced. A bunch of the Arab regime stopped the marching. So, for example, this is the protest in Cairo because they were not allowed to march on the border. From Syria and Lebanon, the protesters broke through the fences into Israel and, like, danced around, but then ran away again. The point of that is that the, like, well, one, people got confidence and have all these political issues. Like, people will liberate others if they can. The second is that Ismail could do very little to stop them. the threat of the potential of these revolutions spreading meant that Roosevelt would say, can you stop doing that? Rather than barrel bombing people. That is important. If we think about the kind of genocide that's happening now, the thing that puts these fuckers back on the back foot is mass uprisings and the threat that those mass uprisings will keep spreading. Here we are. Arguably, things are worse in the Middle East now than they were before the revolutions. You'd probably win the argument. Shit's worse. The question of why and how we got here really matters. Understanding what went wrong matters kind of fundamentally. And so let's go through it. There's a prolonged upheaval in the Middle East, and it takes a couple of years for the ruling classes to restabilize this situation. Let's look at how they did it. The first thing to say is the fucking brutality of the ruling class. It's a really important lesson for us to learn. The people get confidence when they stand up and fight themselves, but then to be put back in their boxes, but then to go back to the kind of shit that life was, actually requires some horribleness. People might know some of the stuff about the Syrian oppression. Have people heard this song? It's Time to Get Out for Shock. The best song. You ever had a bad day? Play this song. This is Homs. And this is a famous Syrian singer singing this song about how you should get out, and like the whole crowd singing. Amazing. Not long after this was recorded, this singer was disappeared by the security forces, and he was found a couple of days later, falling on the side of the road, his vocal cords being ripped out. That's what a counter-revolution means. That's how you put people back in their boxes. The Syrian ruling class, Assad said, to stabilize the country, he would destroy it, and he went about doing that. Barrel bombs, poison gas, mass torture, rape, murder, cities just destroyed. That's how the situation was stabilized in Syria, and that required the support of first Hezbollah troops, then Iranian troops, and then Russian troops to repress the masses in Syria. When I first started Rania's talk, it was a very different conclusion to that sentence because, of course, now we have seen Assad Assad be overthrown. And part of that overthrown facade was the mass uprising across the south of ordinary people who saw the opportunity as the troops kind of marched to Damascus to get rid of the hated dictator. The process of revolution in that kind of democratic space arguably continues. People fought hard to hang on to some of the kind of democratic gains and organisations of the revolution, and it looks like they did at least a little bit. Let me give you another example. People talk about Syria a lot, and they do it because I'll get some. This is Bahrain. It's going to get to you in a second. This is Bahrain. This is a central roundabout where the occupation in Bahrain happened. This is one of the first massacres of the Council Revolution, and it happens in March. Early in the morning in March, security forces, tanks, helicopters marched into the camp and fucking murdered people. Countless people were shot. Later in the day, the local hospital was raided by the security forces, and they found all of the people who had been had protest-related injuries. They locked them into like protester wards, denied them medical care, and fought for them. They also arrested the people who had treated their injuries, so hospital workers. This is one of the first crackdowns of the counter-revolution. Yemen is another one, and Yemen brings us to a really important point about the horror of capitalist barbarity. The civil war in Yemen caused mass destruction, including a famine that killed tens of thousands. Why did it happen? Because to stop a revolution, to break people's confidence, means brutalizing them. And this is something that I think is really, really, really crucial. The ruling class is hostile brothers, as Marx called them. The ruling class, they compete with each other, yeah? They're competitors, they're hostile, they're in curations with each other. But when the chips are down, and the question is class rule or revolution, they're on the side of class rule. And so this is one of many kind of jokes about Obama and his take on the Syrian revolution. He kept saying, "Joe, do that horribleness, don't do that horribleness," never did anything to stop it. Meanwhile, his friends in Saudi Arabia, the US allies in Saudi Arabia, cracking down in Bahrain and Yemen. Actually, people often talk about the kind of revolutions that succeed in overthrowing their dictators. They include Tunisia and Egypt mainly, who had strong working classes. But one of the key things is they were the earliest in the process. They got the mass movement going and they overthrew the dictator before the international ruling class realised, oh, fuck, we're having a problem. Actually, if we keep allowing this kind of hope and inspiration to spread, our class rule is in trouble. And so they, in all various ways, supported the counter-revolution, including funding various kind of governments and conservative forces who attempted to destroy their own revolutions and shut people down. But it's important to say that it wasn't just the counter-revolution that meant the defeat of the Arab Spring. There was weaknesses on our side. One of them is that the masses were just moving into political activity. They didn't have all of this history of kind of protest and self-organisation and that kind of stuff, which meant that some of their political ideas were lagging behind. For example, the Egyptian revolution, the people in the army on one hand. No, they're not. The army is the kind of method of kind of class rule. To rely on a section of the ruling class to save you, to liberate you, is to lose. And actually, it is a military coup that happens a couple of years afterwards that creates the situation that Egypt is in now, where el-Sisi is a dictator who is more brutal than Mubarak could have maybe hoped to be. And you have less political rights in Egypt than you did then. And so kind of lagging political consciousness on our side is one weakness. The other is that there's no mass revolutionary parties. There is organisations. This is the revolutionary socialists are in a stall in Tahrir Square in 2012. There is revolutionary socialist organisations, particularly in Egypt, but they're small. At one point in the revolution, one of the revolutionary socialist people were on the telly and they said something about how the IRS was for overthrowing the government. And they got their website got flooded with people who wanted to kind of join the organisation so much that the website crashed. And like they literally could not deal with the amount of people who were keen to be revolutionaries, who were keen to be involved, who kind of wanted to see the world change in a more fundamental way because they were too small. And so, yeah, that's an important point, that our side needs to be capable of meeting the challenges that come. And then, of course, one of the key problems with the movement of occupations is it can't occupy forever. Like, actually, at some point, sometimes you win. In Egypt, they won. They got rid of the dictator. They kind of key. And then the question becomes, what next? What do you need to do next? What happened in Egypt was they elected the Muslim Brotherhood, who then cracked down on a bunch of the protests, who was then overthrown in a coup. That actually the ruling class has all of these different ways that they rule us. The point is, unless you transform fast society, they'll always find a way to reassert themselves and put ordinary people in their box, whether that is military brutality or kind of reform and democratic elections and co-option. And actually, sometimes that shit's worse because it tricks a bunch of people into thinking that maybe they can have what they want under capitalism. They've done enough, go home, take a rest. But that's not how capitalists rule, and that's not what happens in the end. They just wait till you demobilize, and then they go about doing what they do. So the answer to the question, what went wrong, is that the revolution didn't go far enough. You can't just overthrow a dictator under capitalism, because capitalism is about the dictatorship of the ruling class over the mass of ordinary people. The one figurehead removed just means all of the other ruling class figures can go back and reassert themselves. We need a social revolution, not just, we need to get rid of the kind of state and class structures that support those dictators, not just the dictator. Sorry, am I thing finished? The final thing I want to say is that the kind of political, economic, social questions that caused the Arab Spring still exist in the Arab world, just as the political, social, and economic questions that caused the Occupy movement still exist around the world. And that means that mass struggle will happen again at some point in time. We don't know when. It's always unexpected, but at some point of time, there will be a reemergence of mass struggle. And the question is, are we ready to win? And you get a sense of it, because as soon as people in Syria had the space to start protesting again, they started protesting again, as soon as there was an opportunity. And the thing I want to leave you with is that often people talk about the reason that the world exists the way it is because people don't want to change it, whatever. But actually, as soon as there's some hope that there could be a different world. Sometimes not even the hope that they can be different. We didn't think we were going to change a lot of the Occupy movement. We just thought, oh, there's a bit of a fight going on. Let's get about it. As soon as there is some potential that your activity could change the world, all of these people start to move into that struggle. Those are our people. And like the Arab Spring shows us, that mass struggle is still a possibility. Our question is to meet it and with it. That's all.